Most of you here know that I'm going to be on my way out of the monastery tomorrow afternoon. Paul just arrived to take me down to San Francisco for a flight on Monday. I'll be heading back to England, where I was since last November up through March, helping Ajahn Pasano, Lungpho Pisano, at Amaravati, as he's covering for Ajahn Amaro, who's on a year-long sabbatical. And as, again, most of you know, I came back in March and have been here for 4 months because of a need for some heart surgery that seemed to be best to be done here in the States rather than in England. And so that's been done and it's accomplished, and I'm ready to go back to resume my time in England. So this will be, presumably, unless something happens between now and tomorrow, my last evening here, for the time being anyway. So the past 4 months have been very useful in my daily contemplations about uncertainty and the need for a sense of motivation and non-complacency in practice, having had a fairly major surgery and correcting a defect, thankfully, it seems to have done, but gives one this wake-up call. I mean, I'm not sure how much I needed a wake-up call, because I have been trying to really contemplate aging, sickness, and death for many, many years now, and with my coming up on my 70th year in August, it's staring me right in the face, and then this episode kind of helped nail it even more strongly. But this sense of not getting complacent, not being lacking in diligence as time goes on, as time relentlessly passes. And I'm not the oldest one in this room, but getting there. And there ain't a lot of time left. A lot can happen to kind of thwart you. And as you are finding out, or you will find out, the energies for being completely on practice all the time start to wane as the body starts to age and lose some of its capacities. So, you know, taking stock, starting when you've got the energy, and really looking at how you want to spend your life. How do I want to spend my life? What's important? Time is short. We're looking for a sense of contentment in our lives and in our practice, but we're really wanting to also avoid the sense of complacency. Many people have been practicing for a long time, many years, both lay practitioners and monastics, and probably have realized some really important and good fruits of the practice, really seen for themselves, seen for ourselves, some of the benefits and some of the ways that the practice has been incredibly useful and helpful. But that doesn't preclude sometimes a sense of complacency, that one has to be on guard, to be diligent, to not fall into a sense of complacency, good enough, until the path is complete. And sometimes it can be frustrating, too. Sometimes we hit the doldrums in practice when the relentless conditions that keep us caught making the same mistakes over and over again just keep arising in the mind, and we keep falling for them over and over and over again. I talked about that a little bit this morning, that kind of sense of, oh no, not again, you know, the same mind state, this persistent habit arising yet again after 30 years of practice, this underlying tendency that I have towards whatever is rearing up again and finding an object to land on and grow and proliferate with. So if we get overwhelmed by that, and let it control us and let it just manifest over and over again without any real clear consideration, then we just become the victim to these old habits. And we need to constantly refresh our motivation of why we entered the practice in the first place, to maybe help relieve, understand, and find a more useful, effective way to deal with the dukkha, the suffering that we all feel, the unsatisfactoriness that we all feel, particularly when combined with the manifestation of these old habitual mind states that just seems so relentless and so entrenched. But if we're honest and we reflect, particularly back on our initial motivation, if we, you know, look closely, we see that there's really nothing else to do but keep hammering away, keep working, keep persistent, keep our determination strong, and saying, as I mentioned this morning's reflection, that if it takes the rest of this life and if it goes into more lifetimes of practice with this, I'm going to see it through. I'm going to see it through until it's not controlling my life anymore. Whatever it is, I'm willing to be with it for as long as it's going to be there, and then just to hold it, understand it, learn how to relax, open to it, let it go without holding on, over and over again until I need to do that. Because the mind states, the habits are so, so persistent, so ingrained, and we fall for them so easily. I'm reminded of a kind of an incident that happened, and I've reflected on this before in talks, so please forgive me if you've heard it before, but it's one that just makes me smile because it's so much an example of what it is that we do with our lives a lot. And it's an incident that happened well before I was a monk many, many years ago when I was visiting my brother, whom some of you have met, because he was just here with my sister a few weeks ago for a few days. But it was, I don't know, 35 years ago at least, maybe 40 years ago, probably at least that I was visiting him at his house in North Carolina. And we were sitting at the table, dinner table, having dinner. And he had a beer that he was drinking for the meal, with the meal. And we were just sitting there, and this housefly came and was circling around and ended up landing in my brother's beer. And I don't know if he was actually taking a drink, but it kind of looked like it. And after a few seconds, and my brother and I were just kind of sitting there looking, you know, okay, what's going to happen here? And then the fly jumped up off of the surface of the beer and left the cup and landed on the countertop or the tabletop right next to it, and kind of was stumbling a little bit, kind of like falling on its side and, you know, trying to flap its wings a little bit and not really getting very far. And then it would go up and go back down and go up and go back down. And we were just kind of watching with maybe a combination of amusement and amazement. And then it finally got up enough steam to lift off and circled around a couple times and went right back into the beer and did the same thing. Kind of sat there for a minute or two and then jumped up, flew out, staggered around for a while on the tabletop as we were watching. And this is the truth. It got up, flew around, and went straight back into the beer for a third time. And did the same thing. And then after that, it managed to get its path away from doing it again. We don't know whatever happened to it. But it was a great metaphor for what we do, I think. We just keep on constantly going back for more, no matter, you know, how much trouble we're getting into and how unsatisfactory the experience is. And it's not, it's sensual desire, it's all the other things that can get us, our angry habits, our ways of responding, our fears, our anxieties, all of these go-to mind states that have become ingrained in us. We repeat the same mistake over and over again. And it's good to remember, I think it was Ajahn Chah who said, 90% of the practice is making the same mistake over and over again until you just get tired of doing it. But it takes a certain amount of diligence and honesty to keep on facing up to it and saying, okay, did it again. Okay, have I had enough? What can I do? Where can I find a sense of longer lasting happiness and let go of the temporary short go-to impulses? Acting out on our desires, our aversions, our anger, our irritations, fears, and our anxieties, always letting them control us and where we put our attention and how we work in the world. You know, there's no question life has got its mixture of pleasant and unpleasant things, and we just need to learn over and over again how to mitigate the constant going back and forth from seeking pleasure, avoiding pain, dwelling in confusion, and really keep on reorienting ourselves to that. What's the strategy for long-term contentment and happiness? Something that will last. So just really wanting to encourage people not to give up. There's sometimes lots of reasons in our head to give up, move on, do something else, whether it's in the monastic life or the lay practitioner's life, because sometimes it seems like it's very daunting. But if we remember that initial motivation and the wish for a much more stable refuge, then we use that to say, okay, keep going, keep going. The Buddha gives a bit of a teaching on what he calls the two qualities that are most conducive for development along the path, external quality and an internal quality. The external quality is dwelling with, having in being in the presence of wise people, kalyanamita, spiritual friends, who will help keep us on the path. And along with that, not explicit in this particular teaching, but is being in place, suitable places. So it's like the first two of the highest blessings in the chant that we do frequently. Avoiding those of foolish ways and associating with the wise is the first of the highest blessings. And then the second one is living in places of suitable kinds. So we need to have the correct external environment to support us and to encourage us, and not to get involved with people who are not going to help us, who are going to take us away from the path. We have to dwell with the right company, because we almost all of us can't do it alone. Very few of us are able to do the path alone without that support. And it takes full-on support of people around us to keep us going and not get distracted, keep the focus. And to learn from people who have walked the path or are walking the path and have a commitment to it and have some familiarity with the path and its benefits and can help show the way. So we have to associate with people who are committed and who have some realized some benefits from the teachings. Doesn't have to be a full-on enlightened master, but people who are sincere and committed. And we have to nurture those kinds of relationships and learn from each other. We have to find an environment to do it in. And sometimes that's difficult. People are honed into areas where maybe their families are, that's far away from supportive environments like this, or job kinds of restrictions keep people from being able to access places that are suitable for practice. But sooner or later, we start to prioritize what's important in our lives. And sometimes you have to make compromises. One has to make compromises and let go of some familiar places, some familiar settings, to draw closer to that which we want to be near, that which we want to be around to encourage our practice, and where other people will gather who are interested in the same thing. So we have to have a suitable venue. And it's, again, easy to fall into complacency with that. And even, you know, particularly in the monastic life, we've got choices of where we can dwell, where we can spend time as monastics. And it behooves us to take advantage of other places and to also see when it is that our movement around is just out of restlessness. Oftentimes, it's good to avoid complacency with staying so long, so many years, say, in one place. If that's contributing to complacency, then we need to question and say, okay, do I need to get some fresh air somewhere, get a different perspective, maybe experience a different teacher? When is that useful to kind of brush off the dust? Or the opposite can happen too, just out of restlessness and a bit of dissatisfaction, something's not going right, the grass is greener, that kind of effect. If it's something's uncomfortable, then what I need to do is get out of it, get away from it. Sometimes that's necessary. Sometimes that's just restlessness and inability to stick to it. So we have to know for ourselves what's at play when that's going to be happening. And just to remember that if we're planning to leave and move on, and this is true in lay life as well, try a different tradition, try a different teacher, maybe a different kind of spiritual path if that's looming for us, than to ask, well, am I just running away from something, or am I running to something? Am I being drawn by something that's very good, very useful, and not just trying to avoid something that's maybe a bit uncomfortable or unsure? So it's a good maximum to think about when one is considering, am I doing this out of restlessness or out of a need to kind of shake things up and learn something new? Am I going towards something rather than just running away from something? So these are kind of aspects that we can consider when we're considering our external supports, but always making sure that the Dhamma, the goal, the practice is what's foremost in our mind, and how we can best support our own individual needs and how we can best support the various communities that are trying to keep this teaching alive, keep this teaching intact and available for future generations. Because if we don't finish our work in this lifetime, we may be part of the future generations as well. So those are the external factors that are the main external factor that's most conducive for development of the path. The internal one that the Buddha talks about as the most important, one of the most important factors, is what's called wise attention, yoniso manasikara. And it's the most important internal factor that one needs to nurture and cultivate. So where we put our attention, where we put our energy, where we put our mind, and what we bring into our reflections, how we attend to the various things that arise in the world, is a key factor in the development of our practice. There's a really wonderful, comprehensive teaching sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, the second discourse in the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle length discourses, called the Sabbasava Sutta. And it translated by Bhikkhu Bodhi, at least in his versions, all the taints. Sab meaning all, sabba, and asava often translated as the outflows, which is kind of my favorite translation, but Bhikkhu Bodhi uses the word in this book as taints. So taints, outflows. Some people call it the influxes, just the opposite in the sense of the outflows. The fermentations, right, is one of Ajahn Jeff's translations. But it refers to this basic outflows of the mind, the energy into the mind energy, into sort of obstructive states that keep us revolving around in samsara, in the endless realm of birth and death over and over again. And this sutta talks about the importance of yoniso manasikara, the wise attention, in terms of helping to dispel our habitual interface with the asava, the taints, the outflows, the importance of yoniso manasikara. And he kind of points out a number of different ways, using wise attention, that one can help dispel the outflows. So the outflows, the asava, are usually three in number in the Buddha's teaching. Sometimes a fourth is added. But there's the first outflow of kamasava, of the outflow towards sensuality, the mind that goes out towards the sense spheres and gets involved with them for the purpose of seeking some sort of gratification, some sort of pleasurable experience in the realm of sights and sounds and tastes and smells and tactile sensations and even thoughts, the intellect. We look for gratification in that realm. And the mind is constantly flowing out through the senses into the world around us, looking for some sort of sense of gratification, happiness, pleasure, even if it's just temporary. The second asava, the second outflow, is bhavasava, or the outflow of becoming, the outflow towards being, towards existence, in its kind of raw essential nature, just that essential drive that is really why we're here, why we keep getting reborn into any realm that we get reborn into. It's this basic thrust towards wanting to be, wanting to exist. And it also manifests in our daily lives as the force of becoming, whether we're not just to exist as a physical human being, but as to establish our sense of identity around anything. This force of wanting to have some sort of reassurance, some sort of ground in our perceptions that things are here, they're me, they're stable, they're who I am, and everything's okay. This kind of sense of groundedness that we're looking for in the world around us. So that's a sense of this drive towards becoming bhavasava. And then the third outflow of mind, where the mind often finds itself moving towards, moving out towards, is avijasava, or the outflow of ignorance. Basically not seeing things in terms of the Dhamma, not seeing things in their transient, the world in its transiency, not seeing the world in its basic unsatisfactoriness, not seeing the world in its essentially impersonal nature, that there's just this set of constant waves of underlying tendencies that are causing us to look for satisfaction, look for permanence in that which is inherently unsatisfactory, inherently unstable, and developing a sense of ownership and a perception of self around the whole thing. So that's ignorance, and the mind that's constantly moving in that direction by not being able to see clearly the way things are. So this is how the mind keeps flowing out, the asava. And the asava are what the Buddha was able to overcome, was able to stop the flow of those movements of mind in the night of his enlightenment, the third watch of the night of his enlightenment. He saw the ending of the asava, the stilling of that whole process, the ending of rebirth kamma and full and true liberation from those flows. So the sutta enumerates several different ways that we can help stem the flow of the asava, and breaks it up into about, I think he uses seven categories. They're not completely exclusive. It's not the sum total of that part of the practice, but it's a very neat collection of reflections about what we can do actively to help keep the mind through appropriate attention and avoiding inappropriate attention. So appropriate attention is that which is able to know what it is that causes unwholesome states to arise and knows what causes wholesome states to arise. And one then puts one's attention in the appropriate way, rather than doing just the opposite. So I think what's really useful about these categories is that it's a clear demonstration that it's not just the meditation that we need to pick up on to fully develop the path. There's many, many aspects of our training to engage in that help stem the flow of the asava. So the meditation practice is part of the development aspect of the path, but there are many other things to do to consider as well. The first one that he talks about is under a category labeled as seeing. So maybe just to quickly state, if I can remember them, the seven categories that he talks about in the sutta are taints, the way that we can abandon these taints or outflows by seeing, by restraining, by using, by enduring, by avoiding, by removing, and then lastly, by developing. So those are the seven categories from this sutta about how to restrain the taints from arising. So seeing refers to just knowing how this process works. In a sense, it's part of right view, and seeing correctly the way the world works, the workings of kamma, the workings of what it is that the path is all about. And not getting lost in useless ways of speculating about the nature of the world or the path, not getting lost in views of self, not having, you know, spending time in debates and considerations around, you know, sort of metaphysical questions like, who am I? You know, who was I? You know, what was my past lives like? What are my future lives going to be like? How does it all work? You know, do I exist? Do I not exist? Do I both exist and not exist? And then the nature of the world, of different kinds of philosophical endeavors that one can get lost in, that trying to establish a sense of conceptual understanding and trying to define anything around a sense of me or mine is going to result in suffering, and that this is a useless way to spend our time in this kind of useless speculation about the nature of myself and the nature of the world. And that essentially, the most important way that we can apply right attention, yoniso manasikara, is looking at our lives, our phenomena, our experience within the lens of Dhamma, basically the Four Noble Truths. Examining our experience through the qualities of, is this satisfactory or unsatisfactory, the truth, the noble truth of dukkha, the cause being the craving, the various kinds of sense craving, craving for becoming, craving for annihilation. And those are the causes. Looking at our experience as the most useful way to cultivate the path with the Noble Eightfold Path, and then examining the results of that in terms, hopefully, of more freedom and the potential for complete freedom. So looking at all of our experience rather than in a speculative, with speculative views that are endless, we abandon our outflows through this seeing correctly, seeing our experience through the Four Noble Truths. So the next category of restraint refers to the practice of sense restraint. And this is sometimes misunderstood as shutting one's sense bases completely down, going into an isolation tank, not having to deal with anything, with anybody. It's this sometimes confused with this sense of I need to annihilate everything that's unpleasant or distracting in any way whatsoever and just be completely on my own, not engage with the world to the best extent I can, or just engage minimally. And this is what sense restraint is. And it's a confused interpretation of what the Buddha taught about sense restraint. So he never taught us to, there are certain things which we'll get to in the, one of the next ones, avoiding. We want to avoid immersing ourselves in situations, sights and sounds and tastes, etc., that will lead to further confusion and excite desires and excite aversions. We want to not necessarily thrust ourselves, we don't want to necessarily avoid all of those kinds of things, thrust ourselves into them, and then we don't also want to try and annihilate them either. So that we have to realize that we are part of the world, we get involved with the world, we have to interact with the world to just make it through, whether we're in the monastery or out in the world, the lay life. We might have this desire to be a hermit and to get away from it all. And sometimes there's benefits for doing that for periods of time. But generally speaking, you don't learn what you need to learn by that kind of isolation. So we don't close ourselves off. We don't close off the sense bases. We don't go into a sensory deprivation tank. We don't go on permanent retreat where all of our needs are taken care of for us. But we learn how to interact with the world in a restrained way, so that through clear seeing, through looking at things honestly, and this is where some of the teachings on renunciation and whatnot are very useful, is we learn how to not attend to the particular features or qualities of our interactions, or the people that we're with, the events of our lives. We learn to restrain how it is that we go out to them. And essentially this process of going out, this outflow into the realm of the senses in such a way that it supports and encourages that continuation and acceleration of, say, sensuality or aversion or confusion. So we learn how to attend appropriately. It's not that we avoid attending altogether, but we learn how to see with wisdom what it is that is causing us to be pulled out. And as we do that, the tendencies towards getting confused and lost and overwhelmed by the by those underlying movements of mind will start to lessen as we look at the world around us and not get pulled out, not get fooled by the world of appearance. So this is what sense restraint is. And then, you know, we start to see things in their true nature, more as kind of we learning that we attend to the things that we want to attend to that excite the mind, and that we don't have to do that. We can attend to other qualities of the world around us that don't reinforce that tendency. So those are the ways to stop the asavas through restraint of the senses, not going out to the objects around us. The next one of using is something that Ajahn Chunda talked a fair amount about, the last one pra talk of how to attend to using our four requisites in an appropriate way. So using appropriately food, shelter, clothing, and medicines, the four requisites that the Buddha said we can take advantage of, how to use them wisely, not using them for gratification or for excitement or for fun, for pleasure, but just using the four requisites in a way that is useful and supportive to maintaining this body, this lifestyle, in as simplest way as possible. So, you know, just enough food every day just to get along without necessarily making a big deal about it. Just the minimum amount of clothing and requisites necessary, shelter for a night, and medicine that is basic and not above the standard of the people around us. So learning how to use requisites carefully, and when we're finding that we're indulging in them or using them for pleasure that is very transient, then we learn how to restrain that. We learn how to develop a determination, move back to simplicity. So using our requisites wisely as a way of helping to settle the mind and reduce the outflows of the mind, this is wise attention. Enduring difficult situations, painful sensations that we don't have any control over, when the food and the medicine and the requisites don't prevent the painful situations that can arise, like getting older and getting sick, then we learn a sense of patience, of endurance, of how to hold that without being overwhelmed. We can't avoid unpleasant feeling in our lives. We can sometimes mitigate it a little bit, but we have to develop a sense of patience, being able to hold that which we don't have any control over, how to bear with and be present with that which is unpleasant, how to peacefully coexist with the unpleasant, as Lumbar Sumedho would say, how to peacefully coexist with that which is difficult. So that's a part of enduring, and it's not just physical, it's situational, and the difficult situations we have with people, situations that we find ourselves in, events. We have to learn how to be with those when there's nothing we can do to help mitigate them, and without spending a lot of time and energy and useless lamenting about the difficult social, difficult issues. We do what we can do, and then we let the rest unfold as it will. Or our own internal mind states, enduring the relentless nattering, the relentless thinking, or the relentless habits that we keep on encountering, the mind states that we really wish we didn't have to experience, making that determination of saying, okay, for as long as it takes, I'll try and be with this, to open to it, to relax around it, to let it manifest, not to indulge in it, not to push it away, to let it manifest, have its time, and pass away on its own steam. That's using the Dhamma. That's using wise attention. We don't try and avoid those difficult situations. We endure them with openness and patience, not a gritting our teeth kind of patience, but a sense of open acceptance with that which is unpleasant. So then there's avoiding places where we know we're going to encounter trouble, wrong resort, essentially. And that, you know, means obvious things like dangerous places where we could fall into harm, but also places where, but that also includes places that will draw us into unskillful habits. So if we have a problem with alcohol, we don't go to hang out in a bar with our friends and try not to, you know, engage. We just don't go there. So it's knowing what it is that's going to be a danger for us. And if we don't have to find ourselves in that kind of place, then we don't do it. We avoid that. And we avoid, you know, situations where it's going to draw us into difficult company too, people that are going to try and tempt us away from our precepts, particularly the five precepts, or to try and distract us from what's important in our life. So avoiding certain circumstances is a very appropriate form of attention, a way of developing or a way of nourishing wise attention for the ending of the asava. Then we have removing. And that's basically knowing when thoughts, this is related to the second path factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, right intention, right thought. This is knowing when thoughts of craving, sensuality, thoughts of ill will, thoughts of harmfulness are starting to invade our mind and potentially overwhelm it. And the removing is the quality that we're looking for. We're looking for a way of abandoning those. And there's different techniques to when these kinds of mind states start to arise. There's a whole sutta called The Removal of Distracting Thoughts, which is a great one if you haven't read it, in the Majjhima Nikaya again, middle length discourses. And it starts with substituting skillful thoughts for unskillful thoughts, like a thought of anger arises, you know, substituting a sense of patience or kindness, if one can do that, but to practice those even before the thought of ill will arises, so that you've got it more developed in the heat of the moment. And then other ways of dealing with it are just recognizing the danger and indulging in it, knowing the harm, reflecting on the harm that it can cause, just basically setting it aside and ignoring it, not paying attention to it, turning one's attention somewhere else more skillful, looking more, or if those don't work, we're looking back to the base, more towards the actual internal experience, not just the negative thinking, but the actual unpleasantness of a memory, of a perception, of an interaction that's causing the unskillful thought to arise, and going back to its base, back to its core energetic, experiencing the energy and the affective experience at its base, rather than just getting lost in the story. And if all of those don't work, then sometimes a forceful, as the Buddha calls it, crushing mind with mind, just saying, no, not paying attention to that, not suppressing something that arises as a memory or a perception that triggers it, but not letting it flow into further negative thinking and telling the story over and over again and plotting the strategy to get even or to get what one wants. Just saying no. If it's overwhelming and you can't control it, just forcefully turn one's attention away from it and go somewhere else, do something else. So we can abandon some of these outflows of mind through proper removal of these problematic ways of thinking. Then the last way of supporting wise attention and ending the outflows, the ending of the asava, is through development. And this is where we talk about our contemplative practice. Basically, it's developing, in this particular teaching, developing the seven factors of enlightenment, which starts with mindfulness, goes through various investigations of teachings, what's going on in our minds, the presence or absence of hindrances or skillful qualities, and the gradual development of the contemplative practice of development, enjoyment and tranquility, collectedness, composure, as the mind starts to gather through our wise reflections and then pulls together so that all the different phenomena that arise in one's mind, pleasant, unpleasant, confusing, are seen clearly with equanimity as one of the highest qualities of the conditioned world that we can develop. So the qualities that come from meditation are that final category of ways of developing, dealing with the asava. And that last one is so important. It's where we can find our alternatives to what we've usually been seeking our pleasure from. And can't really underscore the importance of finding enjoyment and pleasure in our contemplative practice. And we need to be sometimes very creative with how we do that. We need to find the right balance between this kind of just over-relaxation with not much energy and kind of laziness and complacency, which can be sort of enjoyable in a very drifty way, and avoiding the other extreme of like over-intensity to the point where all we're doing is creating more tension in our lives by having certain expectations, not knowing our capacities, and doggedly sticking to something that is probably not giving the right results. So we have to be wise in evaluating our practice and asking ourselves, am I finding enjoyment in this? Is this something that I want to keep doing? If it's not, we need to talk with somebody who is walking the path as well and find out if there's some suggestions for how to refresh and renew and bring some enjoyment and life into the practice. Because if we don't have that, we're going to fall back to finding enjoyment in the realm of the senses or the realm of becoming. We need to have an alternative source of long-lasting pleasure on a more subtle, refined level without getting, you know, like totally enamored of super refined high states of consciousness and turning them into the ultimate part of the path. We have to keep our balance and our perspective always in line with the Four Noble Truths. Is this leading to the complete ending of suffering? So this is the ending, this is the path leading to the ending of the asavas through wise attention, yoniso manasikara. So you can see why the Buddha categorizes this as the single most important quality. What we put attention on and what we don't put attention on is one of the most, if not the most important factors in developing our practice internally. So just to keep the focus, don't succumb to despair, don't succumb to complacency, don't get overwhelmed, don't get discouraged to the point where you just get lazy or pack it in or give it all up, get overwhelmed by the relentless habits that keep on appearing, because there is a solution. The Buddha's pointed it out, and if we practiced a little bit and realized a little bit of the benefits, then we can reflect on that and say, okay, well, if that much worked, then maybe I can have the faith and the confidence that if I'm diligent and put energy and persistence into it and just keep at it, keep doing it, because there's really nothing else to do. This is how we want to spend our lives. So I'll leave it there for this evening's reflection.